good evening and welcome to our service this evening. I should welcome as well. I know Steve already has, but I'm used to welcoming, so I'll say welcome anyway. Tonight we're looking at the book of Esther, which is just before Job, which is another bright and happy book to read. We are going to turn to page 503 in the Church Bibles. That's Esther chapter 4. I'd like to ask, and please don't be embarrassed if it is you, anybody unfamiliar with the story of Esther? Anybody not know it? It's okay. Everybody seems to know it. That's great. That means I don't have to give you a quick overview. So we're going to read chapter 4 of Esther because this gives us a trailer, as it were. You know, trailers, they give you the best bits of a film. And then you go to the film and the rest of it's really disappointing. Esther gives you the best bits, but the best is yet to come. And chapter 4 is possibly the most well-known part with the most well-known verses. So Mordecai has learnt about Haman's plot to destroy the Jews, which you can read in chapter 3. But here in chapter 4, let me read. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, many in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him and put on instead of his sackcloth, to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. When Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to instruct her to go to the king's presence and beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and responded to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and all the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they are to be put to death unless the king accepts the gold scepter and then spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that just because you are in the king's house, you alone of all Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. At which point you get the ba-ba-ba of the movie theatre and the date when it's going to be released. Now, why should we even bother to read and engage with the book of Esther? Who here enjoys royal garden tea parties? Anybody follow them? No, don't be shy. Jonathan almost put his hand up. It's okay, Jonathan, no shame. That's fine. What about cricket test matches? Anybody here? Got one very, I try to follow cricket. I'm stumped. Sorry. Crystal Palace winning the FA. Any more interest in that one? A few. See, I wasn't with the Crystal Palace one until I found out about the Christian men who prayed before the game, during the game, after the game, and even after the game, gave the glory to God. I've actually been following now some of the players' Instagram accounts. I think crack a joke. Why'd you laugh? Instagram accounts who talk about their faith openly in the dressing room. They have a Bible. And suddenly that Crystal Palace match became a lot more relevant to me. Esther, and in fact many stories in the Bible, we might think, why should we bother? So what? Why is it important? And it's not until we understand the wider context of what's going on that we realize, actually, this has implications for me. This is important to me. What does the story of Esther 2,500 years ago mean to me? Why should we be interested in the story of Esther? I mean, most significantly, God is not mentioned in it. So why is it even in the Bible? There's no prayers. There's no kind of prophetic or poetic allusions that are written down for us to read. This seems to be all about how the Jews escaped annihilation and the festival which they called Purim, which we don't even celebrate ourselves as Christians. But actually, there's a lot more going on here in Esther. In a world today where people ask, where is God? What is suffering all about? Why is there so much suffering and hardship? Where is hope to be found? Esther becomes a reflection of a time when God appears to be silent. And just like the Crystal Palace game Saturday last week, the more you understand about Esther, about the context of people and the unseen hand of God, the more life-impacting Esther becomes. So what? So what? What are we going to look at Esther that makes it relevant for us today? Well, the first thing we're going to look at is going to be banquets. Who here likes food? Yeah? Yeah, if you want to get a group of men together, it was said a few weeks ago at the UCM evening, if you want to get a group of men together, what do you have?
Barbecue.
Thank you, Mark. Someone was there and listening. Barbecue. Well, it's not quite royal tea parties in Esther, but banquets and festivals are so important in Esther. They become, dare I say, without being dramatic, the crucible of human wickedness versus human courage. So when you read Esther, look for the festivals, look for the banquets, because they're the places to really pay attention. So we're going to come on to banquets. The next one's a word you may or may not be familiar with. Providence. Not the famous region in France. That's Provence. This is Providence. Not the town in America either. No. Providence is recognizing the hand of God in everyday circumstances. Even in the wickedness and courage that we see in Esther, God's hand is guiding and leading. So we're going to look a little bit about providence. Actually, that is the hinge of the entire story of Esther. And dare I say, the hinge of the Bible itself. And our last one is going to be justice. Justice, of course, is reflected by the injustice and the corruption that underpins powerful men that we see here in Esther's story and indeed the world today. Hope, it seems, is a fiery path through some very dark and wicked places. And Esther's going to speak to those facing injustice and the pain of faith on the path of silent hope. And that's just three things I'm looking at tonight for Esther, because that is too much in the very limited time that I have this evening. And I don't think I'm going to get through it all. But there are a few Esther eggs I do think you should be looking out for. Psalms and Proverbs. If you want to follow Esther alongside Proverbs or Psalms, I advise you to do so. Because the very characteristics you see of foolish and wise men, especially kings, is reflected strongly in this book. And second, to look for the unlikely heroes, the people God uses in this book that we don't talk about because they're like a name that's mentioned and it's passing. We mentioned a couple of them today, which we don't look at. We don't have time to look at. But when you look at the story of Esther, look for the small people that God has placed to be pivotal champions, intercessors in the story. So let's get on to banquet. Oh, that's the overview. Sorry, we've got to get to the overview. The context of Esther before I get on to banquet, very briefly. Susa is there in the corner. That's the head of the Persian Empire. That's where Esther is. Esther takes place in a time when the Jews are returning back to Jerusalem after exile with the Babylonians. Persia had destroyed the Babylonians. And as you see, Jerusalem's right on the other side by the Mediterranean Sea. Esther is nowhere near that. She's at the throne of idolatry and a foreign nation and a godless people. That's where Esther is. And that gives you a clue as to the pressure she is under, along with Mordecai and the other Jews. Esther takes place between chapters 6 and 7 of Ezra. So those of you who've read Ezra, some of you will, some of you haven't. Ezra, it takes the first group of Jews back into Jerusalem. He's the one who then gets them following the law again and getting themselves right with God. Esther takes place between chapters 6 and 7 if you want to have a look. If you're interested in the line of kings, that's all the names there. I'm not going to go through them now because we don't have time this evening. But if you do want to have a look at the kings of Persia, of Babylon, you will see some familiar names like Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, who is the king during Nehemiah's time. So you can have a look at that. I'm not going to get into that now because I don't have time. And here is Esther at a glance. 10 chapters, nice easy read, literally 10 chapters, something happening in each chapter. It moves along like a very good book, and you have the direction from grave danger to great deliverance, and that is reflected in the banquets as well, which we're about to look at right now. Banquets were a common way to celebrate. That is something we can all relate to. We relate around food, celebrations, parties, party atmosphere. We are hearing some party going on up the road in the garden just now. And you've got people laughing and celebrating. Esther begins with a big, full-fledged party. A celebration for 180 days of wealth and power. Very Trumpian, I thought. It's followed by a 7-day banquet where lots of officials are brought together and they eat and they drink. But this is no royal garden tea party. No, no, no. Chapter 1, verse 8 indicates the attitude of the guests. If you want to quickly turn to that, every guest was encouraged to drink as they wished. To basically do what you like kind of party. The men and the women would have had separate parties because, the men wanted to do their thing, the ladies did their thing, but they had their own celebrations. And it was the men who were described here as drinking as they wished. I mean, though 2,500 years ago, I don't think much has changed. The opening banquet, which is here, the king's banquet, was also very important because the king not only showed off his power, he decided in his drunken stupor, he wasn't thinking clearly, and even if he was, then he's an idiot, he decided to parade his wife and queen, Vashti. And that wasn't a, come on sweetheart, let everybody see what a great woman you are. No, 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 this was going to be a harassment case for Vashti. She would have had stood in front of a lot of drunken men and do as they pleased. And Vashti stood against her husband's wishes. If you want to look at the flow, it's the foolish and the wicked, and Vashti is crying out injustice. She will not stand for it. The banquet here has wickedness on one side and courage on the other. And right in the middle of it, if you're thinking, where is God? The providential hand of God preparing a way to rescue his people. Yet again, as Vashti deals with injustice, it is going to be the place of banquets that we find Esther also bringing a cry of injustice. In a place of selfishness and lack of self-control, when Esther has her banquets in chapter 6, we see, chapter 5 and chapter 6, we see
a change in direction. As a king looks for another queen, he's looking for those things that fulfills his desire, his wickedness again, his selfishness. The search for a new queen was not a beauty pageant, as some have described it. It was a, you're pretty, you're going to come to the harem, you're going to be pampered, and then you're going to go in front of the king, he's going to take you for the night, and he'll see if he's happy with you. This was exploitation. This was not romantic. This was not a romance story. This was a horror. We must commend Esther for facing this bravery against, in the face of such wickedness. So when Esther becomes aware of Haman's plot to exterminate the Jews, in her limited capacity as queen, she offers the king and Haman a banquet, appealing to their ego and pride. The scene is reminiscent of the first banquet here in chapter 5, because there's alcohol, there's drinking, they get drunk again. But Haman and the king are not in control. Esther seems to be in control of this the first and second banquet that she puts on. In fact, she is setting up the king and Haman to be able to tell the king of the evil that Haman is plotting and orchestrate deliverance for her people. This may be an illustration, although an imperfect one, of how God works through the circumstances of evil and stupid men. In this case, we could say humans, but in this case it was men, to achieve his sovereign purpose. You see, in chapter 4 we read that Esther was put there for such a time as this. And we're going to look at providence in a second. And Esther, using that position, used it and used the king's weakness to be able to bring deliverance for her people. Whatever we think about that, there seems to be a control here that the king and Haman don't see, that even Esther isn't sure is going to work. The final festival that takes place is one called Purim, which is a celebration of deliverance. It's not a festival of fear or danger or alcoholism, but of justice and deliverance. Purim is described as the only Jewish festival considered light-hearted. That tells us something about Jewish festivals. Esther, the book of, is a banquet sandwich. The scenes of food and wine and pride and wickedness soon transformed into a celebration of justice, freedom and deliverance. Follow the path of what happens at these banquets as you read Esther. You could even allude to the story of the Bible. The Bible is all about food. It starts with a sinful desire for a fruit that has been forbidden because it will bring death. It ends with the marriage supper of the Lamb, where we find complete and utter deliverance in the perfect kingdom of God. And in the middle is the Last Supper, where one man intercedes for the sins of the world. One banquet exemplifies our human tendency to fulfill our stomachs and desires, whilst the other liberates and satisfies and redeems the soul. So that brings us on to providence. Providence, not Provence. Providence is God's ongoing relationship with creation. Now, I don't want to get too deep into the doctrine of providence. Providence is a doctrine that has caused much disagreement amongst Christians over the centuries. Some argue that God is not in control of the world, because why would God allow evil things? God's not in control. God just reacts to the evil around him. Others would argue that God is in control and designs all things for good, even through the evil and wicked things that are done in the world. It's not out of his control. I preach the latter. I believe in the latter. I believe that's the position of this church family. But I do respect and receive what other Christians might have. But I prefer and have found the belief that God is not surprised or surpassed by evil. Evil cannot outflank God's purposes. The devil can't surprise God. It's not like a chess game. And the devil goes, check. And God goes, oh, man, did not see that. Now, this opens debate. It opens questions about providence, good, evil, suffering, pain. Why would God allow this? But as we engage with that debate, let it be a conversation around, let the conversation be edifying and building each other up, not tearing down. One thing is for sure, no matter your position, God works his purposes out and God will win. He's already won. The cross has seen to that. So when looking for God's providence or his relationship with creation, we're looking for three things. The first is to look at God's preservation. So when I say preservation, I mean his maintaining of creation. God holds all things together through Jesus Christ. That is described in Colossians chapter 1. God is active in creation, and he's active here now. This should give us encouragement as well in our own lives, that God maintains and preserves us. We see that through what Jesus has accomplished on the cross. The second is another word I didn't know until this week, concurrence. It's like occurrence, but it works together. And basically what it means is two events or more of circumstances happening or existing at the same time. So whilst Esther is feeding the king and Haman and preparing to tell the king, Haman is planning this destruction of my people, God is there working at the same time within that event, possibly directing that event, if that's what you want to go down. But God is working with it, through it, and even, dare I say, orchestrating it himself. So God is concurrently working with his creation. He makes it cooperate with the created things, enabling the distinctive personalities and properties of creation to work together. And thirdly, God governs. Nothing can happen without God's say-so. Now, there's an overlap between these various aspects. They speak of God's character, his intention, and his desire to bring many to salvation. God's plan is salvation and redemption. When you get up in the morning and you're feeling rough, you can know God hasn't abandoned you. When God is silent, you can know that God hasn't left you on the sideline saying, well, I've been busy with these people today, so you just handle it yourself. I'm a bit busy. In fact, if once again we go to that passage in Esther 4:14, Mordecai, again, a message through someone else, and that's what I'm going to say about that. For if you remain silent at this time, speaking to Esther, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Look at the properties of providence that are coming through in this passage. God will preserve his people, the Jews, because that is his promise. From the beginning of the Exodus, God promises a people all the way back to Abraham. He's going to deliver. God is working with the people. He's working within this circumstance. Who knows that you have come to your royal position? He's not saying that's luck, that's chance. He's saying, who knows that God has actually placed you in this moment to work with you for such a time as this. What time? The deliverance of the Jews. And not only that, God governs. God will see his purposes out, and there's nothing that can stop them. Let's use Esther's banquet again as a brief illustration. In between Esther's two banquets that she prepares to expose Haman's evil intentions, the king cannot sleep. Now Mordecai, Esther's uncle and father figure, he had heard of a plot to kill the king. Sounds just like out of EastEnders, doesn't it? It was recorded that Mordecai had exposed this plot. His name was written down in the chronicles of the king. And of course, Mordecai wasn't even thanked. It was just mentioned, this guy Mordecai saved the king, exposed a plot. Wasn't honored, nothing happened, goes into history. The king, because he can't sleep, he wants his record read. It's like asking someone to read your diary to you. Could you go back and read my good old years back when I was at college, you know, the years of my cleverness and that game I won playing cricket, whatever it was, or the time I went to that royal tea party, whatever it was, the king wanted to hear about his own reign. Tells you something about his ego again, doesn't it? The chronicles being read to the king to help him sleep, and he hears about this plot to kill him. And that Mordecai was the one who exposed the plot and saved the king. And the king gets up and says, hey, did Mordecai get honored for this? And the stewards reading the chronicles go, no, nothing was done for Mordecai. He says, right, we need to get this sorted. Haman's coming in to the room to actually say how he wants Mordecai executed. And he says, Haman, I want you to honor somebody. I want you to honor somebody and give him a robe and a medal. He is such a great man and we've missed him. And Haman thinks he's talking about me. Haman thinks it's him who's going to get honored. And he goes, yeah, well, I think only the best is sorted for the man that you want to honor, king. He goes, great, find Mordecai, the man Haman hates the most. And I want you to honor him. I want you to put him on a horse and I want you to parade him through the kingdom. Imagine the fury of Haman, the delight of Mordecai, all because the king couldn't sleep that night. The number of coincidences you see in Esther is remarkable, but they're rooted in the belief of God's providential work. God is working in even this. That God is working in his insomnia. God is working in that point that the king even forgot Mordecai. Mordecai wasn't honored or respected in his workplace. I mean, God, what's that about? And yet God even then knew what was coming ahead. Mordecai couldn't see it. Esther couldn't see it. The king couldn't see it. Maybe we're facing those moments where we just don't understand what's happening. And we have to say, God, you are going to work this together for good, even if I can't see it. Because God's hand has not abandoned you in that place. He is setting you for such a time where he will bring you his goodness and his purposes. Of course, what we are really looking for here is the promise of an intercessor. Someone who will deliver the people of Israel. If we're inclined to think that our part of Christian life is just to live each day and wait life out, Esther is a story that tells us to watch out for God's providence, even in the silent and dark times. To be alert to work for God's purposes. Indeed, Paul writes in Ephesians 2:10, and it was mentioned this morning by Simon, for we are God's handiwork, creating Christ Jesus to do good works, which God has prepared in advance. Providence. In advance for us to do. So, look out for God's providential timing, especially in the quiet times. Finally, and this bit I have to get through quite snappily. Yep, I'm sticking with that word. Let's come back to Purim, this festival that ends Esther. It's a book, it's a festival that's light-hearted, one that celebrates deliverance. But the story of Esther is about injustice, not simply to Jews, but also to the women of the land. The characters, even the heroes, they're not perfect. Not every action of a hero or intercessor is necessarily just or right. In fact, the king doesn't even face justice for his actions of how he treated Vashti. So is this really a story about justice? Justice and righteousness are characteristics of God and the aims of the Christian life. He engraves them into our hearts. But it is our human frailty that often struggles to see them fulfilled. Sometimes the aim of the Christian life, the justice and righteousness, is masked over by injustice and wickedness. Sometimes we want to please ourselves. Sometimes justice is inconvenient. It disrupts the human thirst for self-fulfillment. But we can also be deprived of justice. And we can respond with anger, frustration, sorrow, and in some case a desire to see justice fulfilled. When you look through Esther, there's going to be places where you see injustice. And you're going to see people taking a step for justice. You need to ask yourself, is this injustice? Is it met with justice? Where is the justice in this passage? What we do find is that good and bad acts are not confined to good or bad people. The king does some very wicked things in this. But he also delivers the Jews. He rescinds his edict to have them crushed. Is he a hero? I'm not going to answer that question. Is Esther the hero? Or was she going to just quietly sit by and go, I really hope this works out? Was Mordecai right in actually standing against those in authority? Was he the activist who thought of, I'm not going to honour my leaders. They're drunks. They're idiots. I'm not going to honour them. Which led to Haman wanting to kill his people. Every human is capable of good. Timothy Keller addresses the accusation that Christians are known for allowing great injustices, and the emphasis is that Christians are known for allowing great injustice. He points to James 1 verse 17, which says, every good and perfect gift comes down from heaven above, from the Father of lights, that is God. He explains that that means no matter who performs it, every act of goodness, wisdom, justice and beauty is empowered by God. He casts them across all humanity. Wicked and evil people are capable of carrying out acts of justice. That's what makes evil and wickedness and a broken world a problem. Because that doesn't make the person just. Doesn't make the person righteous. Humanity is inherently flawed, and that's what we see in Esther, but God's good justice is not. You see, God can work through the unjust and the wicked human systems to bring ultimate justice. But to truly find justice, we need that intercessor, like Esther in this case, who can call attention to seek justice from another power. And as I said, it's not just Esther who does that. Count the intercessors in Esther. The people who stand in the gap between the oppressed and the potential deliverer. Or they take the injustice upon themselves, as Esther was prepared to do in chapter 4. The Bible reflects these truths all the way from Genesis, right through to the cross, and the ultimate deliverer and rescuer of the human race. Christian faith has frequently been the proponent of justice and championing social needs, despite the public and historical failings we see in the media. We must remember that Christianity is made up of frail, weak human beings who make mistakes. We're not all righteous all the time, but Christ is righteous all the time. We're not simply called to sit back and wait for justice to be done. We are called to seek the opportunities to enable justice and even be God's agents for change in the world. Equally, Esther teaches us patience. Mordecai was, in a sense, a silent activist. He was waiting for justice, but when the time came and push came to shove and his people were at risk of extermination, he had to speak up. Esther obediently followed the unjust ways of a king and the Persian throne until she had to stand against it. In Scripture, we're told many times to be patient, to live a quiet life, to obey those in authority, but we're also called to stand firm on Scripture. Protect the vulnerable, help the poor, the disenfranchised. In some of those times, when push comes to shove, we have to ask ourselves, have we come to such a time as this to step up, face danger, death, or persecution for the sake of God's path towards deliverance? Jesus is the ultimate intercessor. Jesus took and stood in the gap between sinful humanity and injustice, and God, and reconciled the world to God. If you want a modern day or fairly modern day in the last 80 years example, a chap called Bonhoeffer, Friedrich Bonhoeffer. He was a man who stood in the gap for justice against the Nazi regime in Germany. It is not a religious act that makes the Christian, but to have participation in the sufferings of God in the secular life. Not thinking about one's own needs, problems, sins and fears, but allowing oneself to be caught up into the way of Jesus Christ. Are we going to be caught up into the way of Jesus as we reflect through Esther? As we reflect through our own lives, as we reflect through our own Esther moments of having to wait patiently, facing injustice, looking for God's providence whilst we have those banquets. Wisely placed, perhaps, Esther comes before Job, Psalms, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And again, I say, read them together, Proverbs especially, and the parallels between Esther and Proverbs. Do we seek the providential guiding of God's character and purposes to such a time as ours, wherever we are right now in our lives? Think about how God is at work preserving you, working with you, through you, weaknesses included, and governing towards the great redemption and the marriage supper of the Lamb.